Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life. The following is the completion of Ilona's interview with Colin Baker, the co-founder of Lock & Union.
Yes. Let's talk whiskey for a second. Clearly, sure. You fell in love, you know, in Scotland, like you described. That was your first product concept. Such a storied land. I mean, really a frame of reference for an average person that doesn't necessarily even drink a lot of whiskey. I think the first thing that would leap to mind is Scotland, of course. That's yeah. where it comes from. And yet, in our conversations, you mentioned that history is a very powerful thing, but being tethered to it is a whole other matter, and that's not necessarily what you wanted for yourself. You wanted to honor that past. But
oh, exactly. I mean, Scotch whiskey is awesome. it really is. I fell in love with it. I still drink it all the time. But if we talk about tradition, we can talk about, you know, draw parallels between Scotland and, you know, France with the wine industry. There is a lot of tradition there. And when I was in Scotland, you know, I'd ask distillers all the time why they do things the way they do. And almost invariably, you'd get the answer, well, we've been doing it that way for 100 years. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously a lot of good things about what they're doing, but what's awesome about our position here is we're able to take the things we like about tradition, the things that we don't think work as well or don't work as well for us, and have developed our own process here. I mean, in a lot of ways, we do things very similarly to Scotland, but in some big, subtle ways, we do things that are very differently. Like, we balance our stills a lot differently. We run our fermentations, by and large, a lot differently. And we end up with a spirit that's, relatively speaking, a little bit more clean than what you generally get off of a Scotch whiskey. Still, it doesn't take as much aging. So I think, in general, in terms of an attitude, it's recognizing what, you know, there's a reason why Scotland is Scotland, frankly, but not being tied to it. And I think it's the same thing that happened in the wine industry. Mm-hmm. You know, people recognize and respect the old world, but the way that winemaking is done in the new world is significantly different in a lot of ways. And it's not as restricted. I think that's the biggest thing, right. Is there, in some ways, laws restricting how things are done, where we don't really have that as much. So we have a lot more freedom to do things our own way.
I think it's a really important point. You know, we both spend significant amounts of time in Europe and, you know, both admire it in similar and different ways. But what's clear to me is that sometimes the new world gets a bit apologetic for itself because it's so young. But in some ways, it's an important benefit because you're not beholden to tradition and regulation as much. And it opens up a whole host of possibilities and creativity and, you know, trying things because the consequences are not as dire as would be in Europe. So when you were developing the vision for your brand, take me to the very beginning. When did it become gin? And what kind of gin was formulating in your mind?
The honest truth about gin is it doesn't take time to age. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to get that onto the market earlier than whiskey. We're making whiskey at the same time that we're making gin. But, you know, gin turned out to be, even though it wasn't what I was as passionate about starting off, turned out to be more of a passion project than I could have imagined. I mean, I drink more gin now than I drink anything else. My gin in particular. So in terms of what we were going for with the gin, is I wanted to get away from what can often happen in this industry where people are trying to be unique by being super bold with their flavor profile. I talk about it all the time, beating over the head with a juniper bush, beating over the head with citrus, beating over the head with whatever. A major part of our strategy with this was to make something that was balanced and subtle and clean, and that's a combination of that recipe development process and the equipment that we have. I mean, we couldn't make something that is, we couldn't make what we're making without both of those happening. You know, without the equipment that we have, we couldn't make something quite as clean with still capturing as much character that we have in it. But just in general, we never want to be too extreme. You know, I think that's something that is kind of a problem sometimes, is subtlety is lost in this industry, especially in the craft industry.
No, as you're speaking, the parallels to wine are absolutely fascinating. You use virtually identical language that, you know, I hear a lot from winemakers. And the most salient point was that elegance and that expression of, in this case, not, it came from the earth originally, the botanicals grew someplace first. However, it's this combination of different flavors that becomes that flavor profile, in fact.
Yeah.
So it is terroir in that sense.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's our own way of doing things. And I honestly identify a lot with winemakers. It's another reason why it's been so nice to be in Napa. You have these people that are obsessively focused on quality. It's not necessarily product proliferation. You know, they have, you know, the grapes that they have, and they make the best damn wine that they can with those grapes. We have a very tight profile of gin. I mean, you've tried all of them. We have two on the market, you know, a third that's coming out 6 months down the line or whatever. But, you know, it's a lot easier to make two or three things really damn well than to make 10 things really well. And so we're really careful with what we do with experimentation that, you know, that ends up on the market. I mean, I was very skeptical about this barrel-aged gin that you have in front of you, because a lot of barrel-aged gins that I had that I just frankly don't like. It's hard to name one that I like, frankly. You know, with this, you know, I trusted in Gian. He was the one who came to me with this concept, and we sourced the best barrels that we could, and made a couple barrels of it, and it came out beautiful. I mean, better than I could have expected, and that's why that's sitting in front of you. We're not looking to make more things. We're looking to make fewer things as better as we can.
And I know that your gin, and we'll talk about it in a few moments, is very awarded and is used in some very important establishments for cocktail programs and such like that. But really, when I first took a sip of it, it could be a sipping gin.
Yeah, it's awesome to hear people say that, you know, and something that we've run into a lot is, gosh, it happens so much. It's become like a trope with us. People have a horrible experience with gin in college. And then they, you know, we say, oh, you want to try some gin? They're like, oh, no, I had this horrible experience in college. I hate gin. It's like, well, just settle down. Please just try it. And we have a ton of people that say, well, hey, I don't like gin, but I like this. And that says something to me, that's the best compliment we can have, is that it's got some broader appeal. But I've never had a gin enthusiast ever say that they don't like the gin either. So it's getting back to that concept of subtlety. You know, this is definitely recognizable as gin to anybody who tastes it, but in some really subtle ways, it's quite different. Like the cleanness, the botanical expression is a lot crisper or more crisp than you generally get in a gin. That's a product of the equipment, frankly. So, you know, I'm proud of it.
No, there's definitely a great deal of delineation of flavors and that elevated experience that you were describing. And I think it's worthy of mention that it's actually quite gently priced for the quality that you get. I understand your retail price is around 40, is that accurate?
Yeah, you'll see it anywhere generally between 39 and 45.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted it to be accessible. I wanted people to be able to use it in cocktails. it's built as a cocktail gin. Mm-hmm. And yes, you know, maybe we could price it higher, but you know, that might work for off-premise, but it's not going to necessarily work for on-premise. Bartenders or bar programs are a lot more price sensitive, mm-hmm. for things that they're putting on their cocktail program. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have these other gin expressions too, is we can have, you know, the dry gin, which, you know, we don't want to price ourselves too low with that either. That's kind of the balance, but we want it to be accessible with all of them. Like, I'm not going to charge $100 for a bottle of gin, mm-hmm. for any of these. I don't want to do that. But I want to be able to bring something to people that, you know, I kind of want to elevate what people think of gin as, because mm-hmm. gin has, let's be honest, for a lot of people, not the greatest reputation. Mm-hmm. And if we can, you know, get people to respect gin as a category more, I think that's a good thing. Actually, I know it's a good thing.
No, absolutely agreed. And as you're talking, the subject of wine, and yes, we're right next to the wine country, but it keeps coming up because, again, you're describing a very similar, almost eerily similar process to what, you know, New World, and specifically California, has or is going through. It has a relatively short history, but a very powerful one. And I think a lot of people in the industry would make an argument that we started out making demonstrably in your face wines. We're blessed with great weather, we grow physiologically ripe fruit, and it's quite clear that the wines are delicious. There were some questions about how age worthy it is, but it had very strong personality. Mm-hmm. And now the trend, again, demonstrably, is about making more elegant, restrained, sophisticated wines. And that's exactly what you were describing. And I think the consumer is clearly aware of it. And I think consumer in some ways is pushing for it. So I find it fascinating that Wine Country found you, or you found Wine Country, and now you're making a product that mimics it so much.
It's so funny that I ended up coming here. It seems like such a simple reason for barrels. And being in Napa, it's so weird how much it just fits with everything that we're doing. Like, we didn't try necessarily to have this image or this ethos or whatever. It just happened to be what we grew into. And yes, there you can draw parallels with the wine industry because they're there, and we think about it all the time. And if we can be compared to Napa, I mean, my gosh, you know, there's nothing, you know, if you're talking about luxury or quality, there's nothing better to be compared to. So I love that comparison.
Indeed. And you intuitively, you know, maybe stumbled upon it, or maybe, like I said, there's some other forces at play.
Yeah.
That motivated you to become a part of it almost by instinct.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that there might be some other products in the pipeline. You said that there'll be another product in 6 months and maybe a whiskey. So
oh gosh, the whiskey, yeah. We haven't really talked about whiskey at all.
No, and it's a tease, because now that I've tried your gin, I want to know what the plans are for the future.
Yeah, we're laying down single malt whiskey right now. Mm-hmm. And the whiskey that we make here is 100% single malt. I mean, that's kind of what our roots are. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to release that whiskey before it's ready. That will be a seminal moment with this distillery. And, you know, you can find a bunch of examples of places that have released whiskey too young. And it's, you know, it's not good for the image of their brand. It's not good for the image of craft whiskey, if you want to call it craft whiskey, in general. So it's, honestly, I think it's going to be at least another 3 years before they release that whiskey. Because it has to be right. And seeing how it's aging now, the oldest stuff we have is coming up on a year. I am more than happy with it. We've had bartenders that we taste them on that were like, well, can we get this now? I'm like, all right. it's going to be a while. But yeah, whiskey is a major part of our soul, which we really haven't talked about as much yet.
And we absolutely are going to now, because that's quite a big word, soul. Tell me about the soul of your operation and what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, when I talk about the story of how this distillery came about, my love for single malt whiskey was the reason why I decided to open a distillery. It's the reason why our stills are designed the way that they are. Mm-hmm. It's the reason why we ended up in Napa was for the barrels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're using, here right now, we're filling, used wine barrels from, I can't necessarily tell you who they are.
A very illustrous producer.
Yes, a legacy winemaker in
a
the valley.
A cult wine producer.
Exactly. And that's what's so cool about being here is it's so easy for us to source these barrels because, you know, we're not a competitor to these wineries. They'll give us those barrels and they're, you know, cheaper than new barrels and they're better from my perspective to have a used wine barrel than it is to have a new barrel in a lot of ways. Like new French oak with spirits can be really overwhelming. But
check with wine.
It can be, but even more so with spirits. It just gets so over extracted.
Wow.
But if you have a first fill barrel in particular, it's taken that, you know, that oak character down just enough and has that extra layer of complexity from the wine. In fact, we didn't even talk about this. Did I tell you about it last time? The whiskey that got me thinking about Napa?
Nope.
The Longer 11 Portwood?
Nope.
Oh, okay. So I was at a tasting at the Scotch Whiskey Society, the University of Edinburgh Scotch Whiskey Society, which I went to, and they actually had better, you know, whiskey tastings than Harriet Watt, surprisingly. But at any rate, one of the whiskeys at one of these tastings was Longer 11 Portwood. From Longrow, but it's the Springbank Distillery in Campbelltown. And it was aged its entire 11 years in a fresh port cask, as opposed to what you usually see in the Scotch whiskey industry is it's, the whiskey's aged most of its life in an ex-bourbon cask or whatever, and then finished in a wine cask or whatever for 6 months a year, whatever, what have you. It changed my life. I still haven't had another whiskey like it. I'm trying to recreate that here. I bought 36 bottles of it. There are 9,000 bottles of that whiskey in existence. I've drank through some of them, but I bought 3 cases of it. And then it won Lowland Malt Whiskey of the Year. And that's what got me thinking, well, if this whiskey is so good, it's aged its entire life in a wine barrel. Well, it's a port cask, but similar. Where in the world can I get barrels like that consistently?
That was a big aha moment.
That's the aha moment that got us to Napa.
Mm-hmm.
I could have gone to Bordeaux or whatever. That's a little bit harder. But even so, in just a small geographic area, where can you get more barrels in a small geographic area than in Napa or Napa, Sonoma, whatever? And it's not just the used wine barrels that we're talking about. I mean, we have two of the best cooperages in the world right down the street from us, Sigimaro and Demptos. And so, yes, we're filling used wine barrels right now, but another part of our barrel program down the line is going to be new French and American oak from Sigimaro and Demptos. I mean, Sigimaro, obviously people know them for the French oak. Demptos, in my opinion, makes best American oak barrels in the world. yeah.
So this whiskey that you were referencing, obviously very special. In your own mind, from the consumer's point of view, if I don't know much about whiskey, but I want to drink well, what is the set of characteristics that you look for? What does a great whiskey make?
Oh gosh, that's a hard question. Needs to be balanced. But then again, I like Ardbeg. which is a peat bomb. To be honest, that's a really hard question to answer with a straight answer. I mean, there are so many different aspects that make for a good whiskey. But
are there intangibles?
I think a lot of it is intangibles. I mean, there are whiskeys that I would say in some ways are imbalanced, but I will like them a lot. Like, I like Islay whiskeys. I love them. The whiskeys that we're making now are not that. Those are more on the balanced, subtle end of the spectrum like we're talking about. But we might get into something more more bold in the future. There are a lot of whiskeys that I like drinking. I like drinking sherry bombs. I think at the end of the day, the quality of the spirit, not necessarily, the wood matters, but the quality of the spirit matters more than anything else. I mean, yes, the wood contributes more flavor than anything else, but if there's anything that's going to ruin a whiskey, in my opinion, it's the spirit. You know, like, a big reason why I like Ardbeg, and a big reason why Ardbeg, you can drink a lot younger, is it's a damn clean spirit. And a big part of our whiskey, our still setup, is designed after Ardbeg.
So kind of the mother of it all, it circles right back to the actual equipment, to the still.
Well, it's the equipment and the process.
And the process.
And the process, but... And the oak too. I mean, if you have a really bad barrel, it's gonna ruin the whiskey. That's what I'm saying. It's a hard thing to pin down. Everything matters. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you know, the spirit matters, the barrel matters, the process of how you make that spirit, the equipment. If you're looking at our philosophy, it's nothing is too small to care about.
Mm-hmm. Devil's
like,
in the details, huh?
Yeah, talk about our water, you know, like, we RO all our water, and then anything that touches our mashing process, we dose back whatever salts we need. Like, Scotland talks rightly about how important water chemistry is to mashing. We engineer our water here.
Wow.
Every part of our process, I could give you another example about why control matters, why every little thing matters.
So what you're really describing is no stone left unturned, incredible degree of integrity.
Yeah.
And pride that you take in your craft, meticulous, dedicated.
Well, I think we talked about it before, about people actually being in it for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
We're into making booze because we love making booze. We're not into making booze because we want to... you know, have a spirit brand. Like, this is what we love. It's our life. And I think it makes it a lot easier to care about all those small details when you are that invested in it.
Mm-hmm. So I think of wine as a lifestyle choice. It happens to be a beverage that happens to have alcohol that, you know, that pairs well with a lot of foods, but really at the heart of it all is lifestyle. And it sounds to me that this is very much a lifestyle choice, that there's plenty of spirits you could partake in, but what you've created, you've brought up the word balance quite a few times, and I think that's what we all strive for in life and wine, and certainly in this iteration.
Yeah.
Something that you could incorporate into your world and, you know, you'll enhance it.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Well, cheers to that.
Cheers. Now let's drink.
Yes. I think you've already achieved, I know you've achieved so much, and I'm going to ask you a bit about your accolades. You've submitted it to several competitions, and evidently they came back with gold medal after gold medal.
It's been kind of overwhelming. So we started distributing in April of 2018, and basically since then we submitted the dry gin and the barley gin to not every spirits competition, but anyone that matters, and virtually all of them we've won something at them. We've won 17 industry awards in 2018. The dry gin in particular hasn't won anything less than a gold or a double gold or best in class. We're 2018 New York International, California Gin Distillery of the Year at New York International Spirits Competition. Esquire just named us one of the 21 best spirits to enter the market in 2018.
Congratulations.
For the gins, it was, the all big national brands.
Right.
Actually for all the spirits on that list. Big national brands, and for us to be on that, says something. Just in the grand scheme of things, just starting out.
How long have you been in production?
Well, we were commissioning the stills late in 2017, but we didn't start distributing until April.
My goodness.
Yeah, but it took us, the company was founded in May of 2015. Yeah, May of 2015, right after I graduated from Harriet Watt. And it took us from then to, you know, the end of 2017 to build the facility.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, it was figuring out distribution, which has its own challenges, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then just putting ourselves out there. And yeah, I got to be honest, early on, it's a tough slog to get people to pay attention to you. And to, because there's so, bartenders and everybody in this industry gets so much crap flung at them all the time. I wish I could say it another way, but it's true. You know, if I was on the other side of the table, I'd be skeptical too all the time. And so, yeah, early on, it was always that struggle to get over to that hump where people are, you know, would take you seriously. As long as we could crack the bottle, we're good. Now people are starting to recognize who we are more and more. And it's getting a lot easier, and it feels good to be out in the industry and have people respect what you're doing. I mean, how hard would it be if we put all this time and money and our lives into this and make this gin and have people say it sucked? And that would be awful. But it's been quite the opposite. So,
well, with success comes its own set of pressures. Now that you have made such a strong positive impression, you have to not only keep it up, you have to be as good as or better.
Yeah, but it has invigorated us. Mm-hmm. You know, like early on, it felt like we'd have to put a lot of effort in to get mm-hmm. something back. Now we're still putting a lot of effort in, but the fact that it's coming back easier and easier, you know, puts you in a better mental state.
Of course.
Where, you know, like, yes, we can do this. We can actually make this into a significant force in this industry, and that's what we want to do.
Where is it available currently?
So, we just landed Total Wine.
Congratulations.
K&L, High Time Wines. We've got a good 50 off-premise, well, actually more than that, 75 off-premise accounts in California. We're only in California right now.
Okay.
And that was kind of a very conscious decision.
Okay.
To start in California and then branch out. We could have poured a bunch of money into marketing, hiring sales reps and everything like that. We wanted to grow organically. Like, I'm very conscious of the people that I hire, and I wouldn't want to have a big sales force out there of people that I don't really know. Mm-hmm. And so if we can grow organically, have other revenue streams, you know, like contract distilling, whatever,
mm-hmm.
that keep the lights on, I'd rather do it that way than go at it like a big marketing firm would,
mm-hmm.
or a branding firm would,
mm-hmm.
And kind of rely on word of mouth and the strength of the product itself.
Well, there's that Steve Jobs-esque rhetoric. You have a vision that's clearly manifesting itself. You have a plan, a strategy, but you definitely, you know, are pursuing something that feels quite deliberate.
Yeah, well, I think it wouldn't work if we didn't have a good product or a good story at the end of the day. Like, this, it's all predicated on that. Like, we have to know that product's good. And, you know, when we get in front of people and we actually tell them what this story is about this, like, they can relate to that. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's not like a lot of other brands in the industry where a story can sometimes be contrived or whatever. Like, this is genuine.
Mm-hmm.
So if we didn't have that, this wouldn't go anywhere. If we didn't have a good gin, it wouldn't go anywhere. If we didn't have the team that we had, this wouldn't go anywhere. I mean, a lot of things have to come into place to make it work. Particularly in this industry right now, where it's so competitive and there's a lot of good stuff out there, but there's a lot of bad spirits out there too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's cutting through all that crap. And, you know, I guess, gotta think the cream rises to the top at the end, right?
Well, you're definitely a very bright example of it. Like you described, in the saturated situation, you managed to stand out so quickly. It's quite a meteoric rise, I must say.
Thank you.
And it's easy for me to, you know, believe that because I have your product in my glass and I know that I would go out and purchase it very confidently. So my hope is that the listener, having heard your story, would be very tempted to try the gin, because it does come with such a powerful sentiment embedded in it. You know, it's an overnight success that took a lot of sweat, blood, and tears for years.
Yeah, it seems like it's overnight. It doesn't feel like that way to me. Yeah, there were a lot of sleepless nights getting this up and running. And honestly, to have someone like you who's been in the industry for as long as you have to care about this, like, that means the world to me. I'm not just saying that. I mean it. So,
well, thank you. Thank you. It's been enlightening and so much fun and so delicious. And I'm hoping that this dialogue will continue.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.